Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I want to say, first of all, how easy it is for Margaret and I to feel at home here. This is my second visit to Holden. It's Margaret's first. But actually, when Leah suggested that we come up, I grabbed the opportunity because, as I said to Margaret, when we landed up on top and Werner came up and picked us up and brought us down. By the time we got down on the road here, I said, I feel at home already. And so that's the way I do feel, and it's good to be here with you. We will be talking to you tomorrow morning about many other things. Tonight, it's late, and I'm going to get started on my subject quickly. Every time I come up here, when I talk to Leo or Carol or others, they talk about the challenging sessions that you have. And this is what I intend this to be, a tough, challenging session. I'm going to shake you up. I'm going to do it deliberately. And I hope to stimulate some questions, and I'll be ready to try to field any questions you have. The business of the energy crisis we're facing is very sadly misunderstood by most American people. This is a matter of supreme importance. But truly, this nation is in mortal danger. Our standard of living, our economic stability, our political institutions, even the safety of our streets, may depend upon whether or not we are able to produce enough energy to maintain our industrial base and allow American workers to strive for and maintain a decent standard of living. And one of the fundamental problems of the energy crisis is that it is not understood by most of our fellow citizens. Another is that some of the basic facts are instinctively rejected. We draw away from them because of their ominous implications for our future. Another is that we're frequently beguiled into thinking that there really isn't any crisis anyway. We can still buy gasoline, after all. This is just another abstract debate between excited advocates of one position or another, and that the more sophisticated of us can treat it with some paternalistic indifference and criticize somebody for not doing something about it. Out of the confused debate about petroleum shortages and imports and prices, out of the emotional reaction to the energy crisis, one fact is almost universally accepted. We must conserve our energy resources. We must reduce our annual energy growth rate. We all agree to that, and we all understand it. What isn't apparent, however, even to many sincere citizens and concerned policymakers, is that the total energy consumption of this nation must continue to increase as far as we can project into the future, even if we establish spectacularly successful energy conservation programs. Of the dozen or so major reports projecting future energy consumption, all agree on this fundamental fact, including even the most conservative-oriented, because additional energy will be required for new homes, new jobs, upward mobility for low-income groups, employment and liberation for women, and more productive and competitive manufacturing processes as this nation continues to compete in a sharper and sharper edge with the rest of the world. These facts would be true even if we had zero population growth starting today. And the Ford Foundation study for zero energy growth actually predicts almost 2% growth per out to the year 2000. So we're faced with a frightening spectrum of problems associated with such an increase in total energy consumption on the one hand and the conservation programs that we must institute on the other. The Ford Foundation report assumes as a reasonable scenario for the future, limiting future growth ultimately to 2% per year. Now this is their medium scenario. This would be a dramatic reduction from our contemporary growth rate of about 3.6%. But there seems to be a consensus that it is a long-range attainable goal which might not seriously harm the economy. I say might not seriously harm the economy. It's important to understand, however, that the 2% growth rate will still mean that we double our energy consumption within about 35 years. That's just mathematics. 2% doubles in 35 years. And within this overall growth, there will certainly be a dramatic shift from the use of petroleum and natural gas to the production of electricity from coal and nuclear fission. And here the annual growth rate must be 4 to 5% per year in order to maintain a 2% overall energy growth, thus doubling electric energy production by the year 1990. Now, unfortunately, most of the debate on the energy crisis, in spite of the perils that we're facing, has centered around the subject of import tariffs and quotas and gasoline taxes and prices and allocation programs and regulations and incentives and this sort of thing. And while it's all important and should not be completely ignored, it tends to distort our perspective. I'll only observe that the action by the Federal Appeals Court on Monday accentuates a continuing struggle between the President and the Congress relative to the philosophy of allowing the free market as compared to a program of controls to limit consumption of petroleum. I don't take this matter lightly, but as I have frequently observed, the obsession by the press and the public to think of this question as the energy crisis is somewhat like wrestling for deck chairs on the Titanic. The stark realities are that while this debate has been going on, our oil production is down from last year. Our natural gas production is down from last year. Our coal production has scarcely changed from last year, in spite of all of our talk. The percentage of petroleum that we import has now increased from 33% to 38%. More railroads have gone out of business, and railroads are a critical element in our whole energy picture. The situation in the Middle East remains unstable, and a handful of anti-nuclear activists are advocating a moratorium on nuclear energy production, our only hope for self-sufficiency during this century. The challenge we face today is to overcome the confusion that seems to paralyze us and to develop now a systems approach to an integrated national energy policy to produce the energy that we'll need in the future. And I want to go back and repeat those words, to produce the energy. If we do create such an energy policy, and if we implement the programs that will carry it into effect, the people of this country can have adequate energy and environmental protection and economic stability. If we fail, the inevitable result, I'm convinced, will be catastrophe. Now, if we're going to talk sense about energy, there are several fundamentals that merit special attention. Any energy policy must be based on the best scientific and engineering facts available. We simply can't afford the luxury of basing policies on fantasies, such as assuming that solar energy or geothermal energy or some suppressed carburetor design or perpetual motion machine is going to bail us out of our problems. Or prejudices, such as an anti-Israeli or anti-Arab or anti-oil company or anti-nuclear energy fanaticism. Or hopes, such as the hope that we'll keep finding enough natural gas or petroleum to keep going. Or the hope that the people of this country will voluntarily and spontaneously reduce their standard of living and accept still higher unemployment in the name of conservation, or because someone tried to panic them with anti-nuclear scare stories. A national energy policy must allow a large segment of our people to continue to aspire to and strive for a higher standard of living and greater freedom and dignity for all. This has always been the hallmark of American society, and we cannot expect low and modest income Americans or average American housewives or those who want women to be liberated to sacrifice such aspirations simply because we suddenly don't produce enough energy to provide employment for our citizens, or because we plan so poorly that all but the most affluent must cut back on their standard of living. Now, certainly each of us should realize that there's a sort of a three-cornered dynamic equilibrium that should exist between energy conversion, transmission, and consumption in one corner, and a reasonable and rational program for protecting the environment and conserving our resources in the second corner, and the maintenance of a stable and responsive economic system in the third corner. So we can't afford the excesses that have marked some industrial development of the past, raping our land and polluting our atmosphere. We can't expect to have energy production without some impact on the environment, no matter how benign the source may seem to be from a distance. And we certainly can't expect to have jobs for Americans unless we produce more energy. So we have several environments to protect all at the same time. There are, of course, those that we classically think of in terms of air and water and land. We must protect them. But there's also the environment of the job market and an industrial capacity that will maintain this nation's national security and economic stability. And finally, there's the environment of our own home and the homes of all those people in the central cities of the East and the Midwest in particular, where we must have enough energy for a decent standard of living. Our national energy policy must strike this dynamic balance in a rational manner. Now, several studies have been completed revealing the relationship between employment levels and energy consumption. Nobody ever thought much about this. We've been investigating this subject, examining trends and data from the period since the end of the Second World War up to the present time. And they indicate that with the fat wrung out of energy consumption in business and industry, as is being done rapidly because of the increased cost, and with more efficient cars on the highways, as will be the case by 1985, reducing our energy consumption by 1 million barrels a day would mean the loss of 900,000 jobs. Now, that may sound pretty simple. The fact is, our total energy consumption in 1985 will be about 48 to 50 million barrels a day. And if we fall below that level, whatever the level happens to need to be, by 1 million barrels, that means the loss of almost 1 million jobs in this country. This may be a pessimistic estimate, but it's the most conservative set of figures we've received of three major studies. And it's based on 30 years of accurate data and introduces a new and important factor in our thinking. I'm going to hold up a couple of charts here. This chart, all I want to do is give you the impression of it. This chart shows the relationship between gross national product and energy input or energy consumption. Notice this is the second 1946, and over here is the present. Notice how they follow each other along. Remarkable correlation between GNP and energy consumption. I'm going to show you another one here, which has, this is deviation from the norm on GNP and unemployment rate. Now, I don't happen to have the obvious relationship between employment and energy consumption, but you can see it very obviously is there. We obviously must eliminate wasteful practices in energy consumption. I'm going to get around to setting some numbers for you pretty soon. However, there's a point beyond which further reduction will seriously impact the job market. And quite frankly, I'm concerned about the stability of our society if energy supplies drop too quickly and too far below normal demand. Energy waste can and must be eliminated, but one man's conservation is all too frequently another man's unemployment. Now, the tough facts about our energy supplies are difficult to accept, living as we have all of our lives with the assumption that American affluence was endless. But one of the most important realities that the American people must all understand is that this nation has, since 1970, truly passed from one major historical era into another one. We've passed from an era of cheap, abundant fuels, energy, and materials into an era of shortages and high cost and international competition, which will at best be with us for many decades. The implications of this transition are far more profound than is generally appreciated, and they are especially difficult for us who lived all of our lives in a culture built on cheap mobility to accept. Nevertheless, we must face the fact that we have almost certainly already burned up more than half of all the petroleum and natural gas that we ever have discovered or ever will discover on this continent or off its shores, including Alaska, and that it will be gone insofar as a significant supply of fuel is concerned by the end of the century. 75% of our energy today comes from petroleum and natural gas. Most of it will be gone in 25 years. As our supplies of petroleum and natural gas dwindle, this nation will become dependent for virtually all of its energy on coal and nuclear fission. But even these sources of energy are really only transitional. Though we must increase our reliance on them for now, we must also make plans for phasing them out in the more distant future and replacing them with other, still-to-be-developed resources. Now, one general misconception plaguing policymakers is the idea that research and development, generously funded, can solve this nation's energy problems in the very near future, like landing a man on the moon or building a nuclear weapon. Nothing could be further from the truth, as those of you with experience in science and engineering know. Even with a crash program, the time required between the successful laboratory demonstration of a concept for the conversion of an energy source to a usable form and the actual significant implementation of this technology varies from 10 to 30 years, and it's usually closer to 30. There's no way, for instance, that a tidal wave of federal funds can make solar or geothermal energy a significant resource for this nation before the year 1990 or nuclear fusion before the year 2000. And we'll dwell on those in detail in a little bit. So while we must support aggressive, imaginative, well-funded programs for energy research and development and demonstration in every area of energy conversion, transmission, storage, consumption, conservation, we must at the same time recognize that the benefits of research and development are long-range benefits, and that this nation must proceed for the immediate and short-range future with energy resources that are available to us today. Now, there's much that we can do with these existing resources if we get organized. We must at once initiate aggressive programs for exploration and drilling for oil and gas, onshore and off. We must explore off all shores, by the way. No area should be sacrosanct. We must explore the potential for an oil shale program and press for early application of improved technologies for secondary and tertiary recovery of oil. We must build new refineries, new ports, new pipelines, new storage facilities for gas, petroleum, and petroleum products. In spite of the fact that we're running out of petroleum and natural gas, this program, along with the most stringent conservation measures, is our best short-range strategy. In fact, it's our only hope for trying to keep our energy supplies for our existing industrial and societal infrastructure as close as possible to future demands. Of course, we have other sources, and coal is our greatest resource of fossil fuel. We're going to have to rely very heavily upon it. However, even a superficial glance should warn us against taking it for granted. We need to dramatically expand our coal production capacity with new mines that meet modern health and safety standards and have a minimum impact on the environment. It would be necessary for us to allow coal to be surface mined under realistic regulations that require responsible reclamation of the land. It would be necessary to restore our railway systems with new roadbeds and new rolling stock and slurry pipelines to supplement them. This alone is a task of bewildering complexity and dimension, involving billions of dollars. We will, of course, come to depend upon synthetic, gaseous, and liquid fuels made from coal. But here the absolute necessity for a systems approach to an integrated national energy policy, an integrated policy, becomes overwhelmingly obvious. For instance, using what my committee believes to be the most advanced coal gasification technology presently available, if we were to attempt to close the presently projected gap between supply and demand for natural gas in 1985 using coal gasification, the capital cost alone for the coal gasification plants alone would be $200 billion in 1973 dollars, just to build the coal gasification plant. Such an operation would require 140%, 0.4 times all the coal mined today just for that coal gasification program. It would require about the equivalent of 10% of the flow of the Columbia River for process water, not cooling water, but process water, just water to be consumed. Now, if these factors are off even by a factor, these numbers are off even by a factor of two, one can quickly grasp the implications of undertaking even one project of this magnitude to the entire nation in terms of coal, water, dollars, steel and other critical materials, in manpower, logistics, and environmental impact, and how each relates to the other and those of every other energy-related activity, such as coal liquefaction, or shifting to new transportation modes, or installing hundreds of new nuclear power plants, or providing new housing and communities for millions of American citizens. Our systems approach to an integrated national energy policy must plan now for these problems, for this year and next, in 1980, 1985, and on to the year 2000. Now, as responsible citizens sort out the facts in the energy picture, it becomes more and more obvious that one of the greatest strokes of good fortune that this nation has experienced is to have our nuclear energy as well advanced as we find it today, ready now to provide much of the energy this nation will need during the next 50 years. Nuclear energy is the cleanest, cheapest, safest, most reliable source of energy available, with the least environmental impact of any significant option. If we did not have nuclear energy available to us for the coming decades, the future of this country would indeed be black in more ways than one. Today, there are 55 nuclear power plants licensed to operate in the United States. They have a capacity of about 40,000 megawatts, or about 8% of this nation's electric generating capacity. 17 more plants will be on the line by the end of 1976. You'll recall that President Ford called for 200 new nuclear plants on the line by 1985. Well, in addition to these 72 plants that will be on the line by the end of 1976, there are 165 more plants that are under construction or committed. If these plants are on the line by 1985, and they can be if we simply eliminate unnecessary delays and provide for construction capital, then this nation will have a nuclear capacity of about 240,000 megawatts, about 30% of our electric generating capacity in 1985. Now, one can appreciate the importance of such progress in view of the fact that each nuclear plant saves the equivalent of from 10 to 12 million barrels of oil a year. Thus, it would require 6 to 7 million barrels of oil a day to produce the same electricity that these 237 plants will generate. And this is equivalent to all of the petroleum and petroleum products that we import into this country today. Incidentally, there are 426 nuclear plants in operation or committed overseas. I want to point out that these 237 plants will produce the equivalent of all of our oil imports today. Now, much to-do has been made by some members of the press about nuclear energy, and a number of false or flagrantly distorted stories have been written and TV programs broadcast about nuclear safety and the hazards to the public associated with nuclear energy. Now, certainly a rational analysis of this subject is in order. This is what we've been doing, as a matter of fact, for 30 years. Leo Bustead, among others, and I have been doing research on this for many years. I only wish that the same high standards of safety and health that have always been imposed by the Atomic Energy Commission were observed by non-nuclear industries. And I wish that the press would recognize how much safer nuclear energy is than comparable non-nuclear industrial activity. And I wish that the press would pursue with such zeal real hazards in the non-nuclear world as they do hazards they have imagined in the nuclear world. The nuclear industry, just as any other, has some hazardous aspects. It is not perfect. Nobody expects it to be. We must assume that sometime in the future there will be some accident causing property damage or perhaps injuries or even death. It's crucial, however, to ask how likely these accidents are and how the risk compares to that associated with other everyday activities. While it's essential that every conceivable accident be guarded against and every reasonable precaution taken, there's a point of absurdity beyond which the rational public should not be expected to go in imagining nuclear hazards or hypothesizing extreme nuclear accidents. Recent studies by Dr. Norman Rasmussen at MIT indicate that with 100 plants on the line, as will be the case by 1980, a major nuclear accident would be 10,000 times less likely to happen than a comparable accident, that is, with 100 fatalities, in a non-nuclear facility. To put it another way, the hazard to any individual or group will be about the same in 1980 with 100 plants on the line as the hazard of being struck by a meteor. Now, predictably, this study was attacked by anti-nuclear activists who said that the Rasmussen report was too conservative, and they did their own figures, and they said it was too conservative by a factor of 10 to 16. So I say, so be it. Then, according to their figures, the anti-nuclear people, the hazard from 100 plants on the line is 10 to 16 times greater than being killed by a meteor. And it just helps us get the thing into perspective. Numerous scare stories have been circulated about the radiation impact of nuclear industry on the general public. Here are some figures that cast some light on this subject. If we assume 1,000 nuclear power plants on the line in the year 2000, the average person in the United States will receive the following radiation: 102 millirem, millirem is a unit of radiation absorbed, 102 millirem per year from natural background, that's cosmic rays, whatever uranium there is in the soil and this sort of thing, 73 millirem per year from medical x-rays and therapeutic radiation, but only 0.4 millirem per year from the operation of all 1,000 nuclear plants combined and all their supporting activities combined. That's less than one half a millirem as compared to almost 200 from natural background and medical sources. We were talking at dinner tonight about who would get the most radiation. I'll run a little quiz with you here very quickly. I'd like to have you imagine some people with me. First of all, we have a man operating a nuclear power plant, like the Trojan plant down that's going to be on the line down by Portland, or the one that's been built over at Hanford, or the other 53, wherever they are. Or a picket walking back and forth in front of the gate saying, "Down with nuclear energy." Or a sailor operating a nuclear submarine under the ocean. Or a guy camped up on Pike's Peak looking at the sunset. Or a guy flying a jet airplane across the country. A man standing in the Vanderbilt Street entrance of Grand Central Station, or a guy out in his tent camping, fixing his Coleman lantern. Which one of those receives the most radiation? Well, the guy standing in front of Grand Central Station receives the most, because Grand Central Station is made out of a granite that contains a lot of uranium. He receives 525 times as much as the picket in front of the nuclear power plant gets in a year. As a matter of fact, I should have put somebody watching color TV set, because every 10 hours in front of a TV set, you get as much, in a color TV set, sitting just a few feet away, you get as much as you get in a year standing at the gate of a nuclear power plant. Incidentally, the guy putting the Coleman, the mantle on the Coleman lantern gets four times as much as the operator of the nuclear power plant, or the sailor, who get the same, which is essentially zero, because of the mantle. That white stuff in the mantle contains thorium, which gives him four times as much as if he were sitting at a nuclear power plant for the entire year. And the guy in the jet airplane, of course, gets more than the operator of the plant, because he's up, and so he gets more cosmic rays. I think it's important to get this into perspective. Today, with our automobile speed limit reduced to 55 miles an hour, we kill about 45,000 Americans a year and suffer about 2 million serious injuries in automobile accidents. More than 8,000 people burn to death. Overdoses of aspirin and aspirin compounds cause more than 2,000 deaths a year. 1,000 persons die from electrical shock. 160 are killed by lightning. About 3,000 choke to death on food. About 2,000 are killed in airplane accidents. More than 200 are bitten by rabid animals. An unknown number are killed by cigarettes. And incidentally, quite a few are maimed or killed by taking smallpox or polio vaccinations. No radiation-related death or injury has resulted from the operation of any licensed nuclear power plant in the United States, nor has any member of the public been exposed to any radiation in excess of internationally approved standards as the result of the operation of all the 55 nuclear power plants and all their supporting activities, and more than 100 military nuclear power plants and their supporting activities. Now, the complaint has been made that no specific permanent waste management program has yet been announced by the Energy Research and Development Administration. Much to-do has been made about nuclear waste. Some of you saw the Today Show recently. Barbara Walters talked about this. Hundreds of thousands of tons of waste that would last for millions of years. Well, Barbara Walters was classifying plutonium, which is not a waste at all, but the product, the reason we run the reactors, the breeders in particular, is to make plutonium because it's a fuel, as a waste. But the wastes themselves have been handled and stored in nuclear plants all over the country now for 30 years. The storage and management of waste is a requirement accompanying the beneficial use of nuclear fission. It can be approached in the same sound manner that we've used in handling radioactive materials for these last 30 years. Millions of gallons of liquid and thousands of tons of solids containing billions of curies of activity have been handled in an exemplary way with virtually no harm to anyone and virtually no radiation released to the biosphere. Using the techniques that have been developed during these recent years, the safe, permanent storage of radioactive materials is actually a simple matter of good engineering and good management. We have the technology. All we're waiting for now is to get the environmental impact statements and the licenses taken care of. In due time, the IRDA will announce its plan. And one technique that I'm virtually certainly going to choose involves encapsulation of the wastes as a solid glass, just like any other glass item, in a welded stainless steel canister. One canister a foot in diameter and 10 feet long, holding about 6 cubic feet each, we poured in a molten state and allowed to solidify, welded shut, will contain the waste products produced each year, I beg your pardon, 10 to 12 of these canisters will hold the waste of a single 1,000 megawatt nuclear plant produced in a year. These canisters can be enclosed in individual concrete shields and simply placed on the surface of the ground inside some restricted area, such as the Hanford Reservation down near where I live. And here it would require less than 2 square miles of the Hanford Reservation to stack these shields out in just one layer deep on the desert in rows. If you could get any one of them and bring it back in, all the waste would be generated in this entire country between now and the year 2000. Would be put there in 2 square miles out of the 600 square miles in the Hanford Reservation. Another acceptable method is the storage of these canisters in geologically stable underground salt deposits. We now have salt beds down in New Mexico which are from 250 to 500 million years old that have never been disturbed. It would take a very small amount of space compared to what's available to store these wastes permanently. We now have salt beds down in New Mexico which are from 250 to 500 million years old that have never been disturbed. It would take a very small amount of space compared to what's available to store these wastes permanently. Now I'd like to do a little chalk work for you here, if I may. You can't all see the way. I'm going to wave my hands in the air and draw curves for you in the air, if I can, and just show you a couple of things. I've shown you these first two pages. I don't know whether you can see this curve or not. This is what we think of as a sort of normal Gaussian distribution curve almost. It just goes up and goes back down again. This is a curve that's been drawn by Dr. King Hubbard of the Department of Interior. Dr. Hubbard is a specialist on oil production, and he's been working on this thing with remarkable accuracy for the last 20 years. For most of that time, his work has been ridiculed or ignored or suppressed because it differed with the figures that the oil companies wanted the public to have. Because he said, we're running out. But recently, before the Ways and Means Committee in the House of Representatives, an entire panel of oil industry and government experts all said, yes, Hubbard is right. Now, you see this curve goes up to a peak and then back down. We're at the peak right now at about 4 billion barrels per year domestic production. Now we consume about 6 billion barrels a year, so there's another 2 on top of that we get from foreign countries. Now this curve also shows that we will be down to 1.5 billion barrels a year, less than 1.5 billion barrels a year in the year 2000. Now, incidentally, this little square from the corner represents the oil reserves of Alaska. Somebody says, why don't you go out and discover Prudhoe Bay and solve our problems? You can take that little square and smear it along the leading edge of the curve here, and it just postpones doomsday by 2 or 3 or 4 years. And that's all it does. Now, incidentally, this same curve, almost identical, can be used, just moved out a little bit, maybe a little bit higher, a little bit further out, for all the oil in the world, including all the Middle East. Every nation has its own date of destiny, and very few of them lie very far into the next century. Now, anyone who wants to can waste time by quibbling over the exact numbers or the exact shape of the curve. The message should be as clear as the common sense behind it. We are on spaceship Earth. We are running out of fuel. It just makes sense, and we should understand it. Now, I'd like to... Now, I'm going to... I wish I could draw for you. I don't know. I'm just going to have to wave my hands in the air. I keep wanting to go over there, but I can't do it. I'll use this again. These are 4 bar graphs that I made. These are just, this is McCormick's artwork with a flare pen. On the left-hand side represents the year 1972, then right beside it is this year 1975, and then 1985 and the year 2000. I'm going to tell you about these graphs because this is terribly important. We start with the fact that our growth for energy consumption through these recent years has been about 3.6% per year. And so if we started with this graph here where we are in 1975 and grew at 3.6% per year, we would be at 87 million barrels a day equivalent consumption. We convert everything to millions of barrels a day equivalent. We are today at 37. We would be at 87. So instead of using that normal growth, I have made a chart using the most conservative official projection suggested. This was suggested by the Environmental Protection Agency. And I beg your pardon, the Council for Environmental Quality, Dr. Russ Peterson, and it's over here. And Russ said, let's cut our growth rate in half, on just hypothetically, let's cut our growth rate in half between now and the year 2000 and get it from 3.6 to 1.8. And so this is what that is. And then he said, this is how we're going to get it, from various environmentally sound and economically acceptable methods. So what you're seeing here is a projection of energy from 1975, which is the second bar, to the year 2000, which is the right-hand bar. Now with that, I just want to go back now and tell you a little bit about the rest of the curve. The left-hand bar is for 1972. In that year, this nation consumed 34 million barrels of oil a day equivalent. Now in 1975, it's up 3 million barrels a day. Now there's an interesting trend that you can't see because you're not close enough to it, but here they are. First of all, domestic oil production is down a million barrels in 3 years, down 10%. That's what this country is producing, has lost that much. Domestic gas is down by a half a million barrels a day, about 5%, but it's projected to go down even faster. Imported oil is up from 4.5 million barrels a day to 6.5 to 7 million barrels a day this year. Coal has scarcely changed, going from 6 to 6.5 million barrels a day equivalent in these 3 years. Hydroelectricity has scarcely changed, going from 1.4 to 1.5, and nuclear energy from 0.3 to 1 million barrels a day as it is today. Now, if you look over here, I projected for 1985 in the middle. Now, these studies are a composite of a whole series of official studies from the Commerce Department, the Ford Foundation, the National Academy of Engineering, the Council for Environmental Quality, the Federal Energy Administration, the IRDA, private agencies such as the Edison Electric Institute, Stone and Webster, industry, environmentalists, various groups. This is a composite of them, and it's a conservative composite. And here the projected consumption goes from 37 today up to 48 million barrels in 1985. Now this assumes then reducing our consumption by 6.5 million barrels a day below what would be our traditional growth rates for this past decade. This assumes an extremely aggressive conservation program. Now, a consumption of 48 million barrels of oil a day equivalent in 1985 also assumes an all-out program for exploration and drilling for petroleum and natural gas. If successful, such a program can bring our declining production of domestic oil and gas back up from the present levels to about 10 or 11 million barrels a day equivalent. Now, several representatives of the petroleum industry say that's too optimistic. Frank Zaib says we can do a little better than that. But the difference is in how much we import. This projection for 1948 also assumes trying our best to double our coal production. But the best evidence we have is that we can't double it. We can go from 6.5 to 10 if we have a crash program, and we'll have a tremendous national, require a tremendous national commitment. Our hydroelectric potential will go up from its present 1.5 to about 2, and there it will stop, because that will have used up all the sites that are going to be developed. The nuclear program is getting all the plants in the line. So here we have it: domestic oil, imported oil, natural gas, coal, hydro, and nuclear, and that's our 48. Now the message here is that we go all out in everything we do, and still have to import more oil than we're importing today, increasing this country's reliance on imports. And the second is that if we reduce our consumption below some critical point in this vicinity, then we'll be losing 900,000 jobs for each 1 million barrels. Now this chart here for the year 2000, Russ Peterson's, I've just simply put in, and I've already described to you what he did and what we did. I just want to point out to you that natural gas and petroleum and imported oil are going down, demand is growing up. This little tiny sliver up here in the top, according to the Council for Environmental Quality, is our total solar and geothermal input in the year 2000. So then, take a look at this thing. Here's what we have. First of all, we've got a declining curve for petroleum and natural gas. In spite of all of our conservation problems, we have an increasing curve for consumption. Actually, it's slowing down. It's increasing like this. But in between, we have to fill that up with coal and nuclear fission. The hydro is just a very small amount. Solar and geothermal play no part until way out at the end of the century. Now, one can argue again with these figures and say, I don't agree with Dr. Peterson. I think we should have more for solar, to which I can say very well, we can double or triple or quadruple the solar energy input. It doesn't change the message one bit. The message is petroleum and natural gas is declining, and the solar and geothermal will make only a very small contribution before the year 2000. Now, I'm pleased to say that Congress has taken the initiative in establishing well-organized programs for solar energy and geothermal energy and nuclear fusion. Incidentally, I was designated the Solar Energy Man of the Year recently by the Solar Energy Industries Association. I don't know whether any of you happened to notice, but I was given this solar-powered wristwatch. And those are actually solar cells in the front of this thing. And there's a couple of batteries in the back and has a digital readout. I don't even see the little red numbers in there. It has a digital readout on it. It's a cute gadget. It has a lot of messages. First of all, it works. Solar energy works. Second of all, it's bigger and clumsier than my regular wristwatch, so I don't wear it. Third of all, it costs about 10 times as much as my regular wristwatch. I think those messages are really very important because they tell a story about solar energy. I want to tell you a bit about the legislation, the solar energy legislation that I've had written as a law. We have, by the way, since I've been involved in the solar energy business, as chairman of the committee, increased this nation's solar energy commitment 100 times. Since I started on this thing, for fiscal 1971, our budget was about $1.2 million. For fiscal 1976, it is about $150 million. We've tripled it this year over last year. We almost tripled it last year over the year before. Now, we've taken this initiative and we've set up some specific programs. The first is the Solar Heating and Cooling Demonstration Act of 1974. This provides a 5-year program to demonstrate the commercial feasibility of using solar energy to heat and air condition residences and other buildings. We envision having 2,000 demonstration solar heating units on the line within 2.5 years from now. In addition, 2,000 more combined heating and cooling demonstration units 4.5 years from now. Now, studies done by our committee indicate that solar heating and cooling is competitive in most areas of the country with an amortization period of 10 to 15 years. But it is quite expensive to retrofit a house, and it will be very difficult to do. We've also established long-range comprehensive programs for all aspects of solar energy indirectly, including wind conversion, thermal electric conversion, photovoltaics, ocean thermal gradient, bioconversion, incineration of waste for energy or the conversion of useful fuel. Now, solar energy will clearly play an important role in our future, and I'm proud of the programs we've established. But I think we have to keep it in perspective. With well-managed, well-funded, aggressive programs, we may be able to produce 1% of our energy from solar heating and cooling by 1990, and maybe another 1% from other energy solar energy conversion, but not before. For instance, if we were to convert 10% of all the houses in this country to solar energy heating and cooling, this would provide only slightly more than somewhere between 1 and 1.5% of this nation's energy requirements. Converting those 7 million houses would, according to the solar energy industry itself, cost between $70 and $105 billion and have all, be fraught with all kinds of legal problems. In other words, for instance, suppose you put solar panels on your house and your neighbor decided next door on the southern side decided to plant poplar trees. What do you do? Nobody's even asked that question in court yet. What do you have for sunrights? What about building codes? These things, nobody's even got them as far as raising the question so far. The same general perspective applies to geothermal energy. In the Geothermal Energy Research Development and Demonstration Act, which I authored in 1974, our goal is a real crash program to have 6 to 10 geothermal demonstration plants on the line by 1980. Now, these are small plants generating from 1 to 10 megawatts of electricity each, using presently undeveloped types of geothermal energy. So if you're not interested in the hot, one, we have hot, dry steam down in California, one place. and we use it. That's great. But it's only one place. And that's the only place in the country we have. We want to get at this undeveloped type of geothermal energy, such as hot, dry rock formations or hot water deposits or geopressured water down off the Gulf. Here again, prudence must govern our optimism. Even with this crash program, it's unlikely that we can produce 1% of our total energy from all geothermal sources before the year 1990. And then finally, nuclear fusion. These past 3 years have been the most productive in history of the controlled thermonuclear research. Fusion is the energy that we think of associated, we think of it with a hydrogen bomb, but it's much better to think of it in terms of the energy that lights the sun and the stars. We're now operating on a new plateau with respect to fusion research, one that we've dreamed of and sought for 20 years. Now, for the first time, we understand the physics and dynamics for the plasma in which the thermonuclear reaction must take place. Now, for the first time, we're in a position to move forward with a much more aggressive research and development program. And now we can, with considerable confidence, predict success. We've almost doubled our fission budget this year over last, and again last year over the year before. I believe that we can have commercially feasible fusion electric demonstration plant on the line by the mid or late 1990s, but not before. And this will require massive support, continuing support, starting now for materials research and development and engineering studies that haven't even started yet. Now, if this program is successful, and it may be in the 21st century, we may be able to look forward to providing absolutely unlimited quantities of clean, cheap energy forever, not only for this country, but for all mankind. We may also look forward to phasing out the burning of fossil fuels and the use of nuclear fusion to produce electricity. And we may be able to look forward to mining the oceans, unlimited amounts of energy, to get materials that come from the oceans in very dilute quantities and are uneconomic today. But not before the 21st century. Now, it should be obvious that we can't reach these goals of the 21st century unless we establish intelligent and responsible policies and programs in the balance of the 20th century. And it should be obvious that this is no time for pretending that there are simple solutions to this tangle of interlocking and complex problems that invade every facet of our economic lives. It should be obvious that we can't afford to base our policies on fantasies or fears or hopes or prejudices. And it should be just as obvious, however, that this nation can develop policies and programs which will provide adequate energy and maintain our economic stability and our standard of living while protecting our and improving our environment and the health and physical well-being of our citizens. We can do it. We've faced tough problems before. Many of us here lived through the Depression and helped fight the Second World War. We never doubted for a single moment what our purpose was, whether we would ultimately overcome the difficulties that beset us during those trying times. I'm convinced that the American people exercise the same resilience and confidence and good sense that we've demonstrated in the past. And if we have responsible leadership and policies based on scientific and engineering fact, then we can overcome these problems that face us today and help build a better world. Thank you very much.
You didn't go much into the hazards of coal. I thought you might want to say a little bit about that. And then on fusion, we get fusion, but you might want to say something about the predicted societal cost.
Okay. First, with respect to coal, we've had testimony now before two committees, one on the environment and one on our study of the breeder program, which I've been chairing, from experts in the field of environmental and health problems associated with energy production. And both of these agree that the use of coal is 100 to 1,000 times more hazardous than nuclear energy at its worst. This goes to the mining. We're paying $1 billion a year today for black lung disease. We still have no way whatsoever to control acid mine wastes. Moving the coal to run a 1,000 megawatt coal plant 1,000 miles from mine to plant averages 5 fatalities, transportation fatalities a year. We still have no efficient system of scrubbers, of scrubbing the effluent gases, and the testimony that we have on the hazards of sulfates from burning even low sulfur coal, or with scrubbers that function according to today's standards, are such that they consider to be the most serious respiratory and pulmonary problem that faces this country. For this reason, I have great problems when we talk about shifting from petroleum and natural gas to coal. The fact is that the Environmental Protection Agency is standing in the way of a good desulfurization technology for coal, because they insist upon using nothing but scrubbers and will support no research and anything else. As a matter of fact, they are blocking utilities from doing research in anything except using scrubbers, which simply don't work. And so we're having a great deal of trouble with that. The other one you mentioned was the fusion program. One of the, Dr. Chauncey Starr, who's head of the Electric Power Research Institute, constantly keeps throwing this caveat into our discussion, and that is that the fusion, for all the fact that if it works, we have an absolutely unlimited supply of fuel, and that we use deuterium from water, the isotope of hydrogen, from water, so we have, in human terms, an infinite source of energy, constantly keeps coming back to the fact that tritium is used in the reaction or produced in the reaction or both, and that tritium is a very difficult radioactive material to handle because it's a gas that is essentially identical to hydrogen in its chemical characteristics and does not home any place. It simply moves around as water moves around and in the air and throughout the biosphere. And if we assume the extreme regulatory standards that we have attached to radioactive materials, if we assume that they're correct and we're going to live with them, then handling tritium in large masses to produce large amounts of energy could be a far, far trickier problem, far more difficult than operating fission reactors and handling nuclear waste from ordinary reactors. Chauncey Starr says that fission reactors will ultimately be chosen, the breeder will be chosen over the fusion reactor, even when we have the fusion reactor, because of that reason. That answers your question now. Yes?
Would you say something about your feeling about the time schedule of the breeder and all? Particularly, if they were, I understand the first project now is with difficulty, cost escalation. Mm-hmm. Still favor going ahead with it?
We have to go ahead with it. I think it's important to understand what the breeder program is. If I may just back up with your question a little bit. A lot of people don't understand what the breeder is, so let me just say it here. A breeder reactor is a nuclear power plant that produces more fuel than it uses. Now, that sounds like magic or perpetual motion, but it actually does do exactly that. Now, this is a little bit complicated. I keep going back and reaching for that chart, but I've restrained myself. The uranium that we normally use for a nuclear power plant comes out of the ground about 99.2 or 99.3% the isotope uranium-238, which is in itself of no value for nuclear energy because it will not undergo nuclear fission. We run our reactors in that other 0.7%, less than 1%, that is uranium-235. That's what will fission, create the energy, produce the neutrons to maintain the chain reaction. Now, when we build a water reactor, a water-moderated reactor like the commercial reactors of today, we make few elements of enriched fuel. We take that uranium and pass it through an enriching device that changes that ratio to about 3% uranium-235. That leaves us with all the rest of that uranium-238 there doing nothing at all. Now, actually, some of that uranium-238 gets converted to plutonium. Now, that's what we deliberately did at Hanford. All those reactors at Hanford were made just for the purpose of changing uranium-238 to plutonium so it could use it for weapons, because it will fission the same as the uranium-235. Now, for any normal reactor, for every 100 atoms of uranium-235 that gets consumed, you make about 65 or so atoms of plutonium. So you get less fuel than you started with, but you get some back. And you can tune various other designs of reactors up so you get almost as much as you use. But a breeder reactor is designed to make more. and it actually works. And it's done, well, there are a number of ways to make breeders. So we have the whole question of having breeders because we clearly do not have enough uranium to run us very far into the future. It looks as though we couldn't even get to the year 2000 with the uranium we have or think we have. So if we build those 1,000 plants in order to which to maintain our society, then we have to have the fuel to go. So the only way to get it is to either find a whole bunch of uranium, which is really sort of in the ocean, or us making it ourselves in the breeder program. Now, there are a number of kinds of breeders. One general type of breeder is called the liquid metal fast breeder reactor. Now, fast just simply means that we change the way the neutrons behave. We don't slow them down quite as much going from one atom to the next as we deliberately do in a water reactor. The water slows the neutrons down. So what we want to do is have something that will carry off that heat to produce electricity without slowing the neutrons down. And we find that can be done with liquid metal. And the liquid metal that works very nicely is sodium metal. So we have a liquid metal fast, that is, neutrons move, don't get slowed down so much, breeder reactor. Liquid metal fast breeder is one of the types of reactors. And all over the world, it has been decided that the liquid metal fast breeder is probably the best type of breeder to go with, at least for the present time, that is, the next 10 or 20 or 30 years. Now, in the United States, we've had a liquid metal fast breeder reactor operating down in Idaho called the Experimental Breeder Reactor 2 since 1963. It runs, it produces its own plutonium, it goes back through the cycle and goes around and around, and it produces a little bit of electricity. It's just a small demonstration reactor. Now, to go from that to a great big plant, you have to go through a series of steps to get there. And at Hanford today, we're building what we call the Fast Flux Test Facility, which is a plant that's about 400 megawatts thermal. And it's small by comparison to a nuclear power plant, but it's an intermediate step to test out the equipment. But beyond that, then we're trying to build a plant that will produce electricity. And this plant now is going to be built at Clinch River, which is down in Tennessee next to the Oak Ridge Atomic Energy Plant. Now, this plant has been plagued with all sorts of administrative problems. And one of them is because, first of all, there's some politics got into this thing. When we built this thing at Hanford, this fast flux test facility, there was a policy decision made it should not produce electricity. It was a very bad decision because it deprived us of some experience and information. So we have to make the next plant not quite as big and go ahead and produce electricity from that. That was the Clinch River plant. Then instead of having that plant just be made by the Atomic Energy Commission, we got into a great big rhubarb about who should make it. And so we got this agreement that we made partially by private industry and partially by the federal government, all working as a team, and it took about 4 years to put that organization together. In the meantime, it kept going through this inflation and inflation and inflation, and the cost of things kept going up and up and up. And now we're projecting it's going to be over $1 billion, but most of that is projected future inflation because we haven't even started building it yet, so it means it won't even be done until about 1983 or 84 if we start building next year, August, as we project. Now, this is way behind schedule. I'll tell you how far behind schedule it is. The French Phoenix reactor, which is virtually identical in size and general purpose to our Clinch River plant, finished its first year of operation on July 14th of this year, and they ran for a full year. They had 20,000 fuel pins in this reactor. These fuel pins are smaller around than a lead pencil, and they had 20,000 in there. And they ran it for an entire year without any failure, without a single pin failure. This is just phenomenal. The whole world is just bug-eyed over the French success. And the French and the Germans and the British have one operating, too. They're having problems finding a leak in their steam generator, but it's not a nuclear problem. They have one built and operating similar to the French. They are 10 years ahead of us. And the French now indicate that they will have orders for four. The Germans, one, and the French, three. Of these 1,200 megawatt breeders, liquid metal fast breeders, they'll be on the line and operating before we get our first plant, our Clinch River plant, finished. So they are way, way ahead of us. The Russians, the Japanese, the Germans, the British, and the French, and the Low Countries in Italy are all ahead of us. Now, the Clinch River plant is just simply another research tool. It's to get us more information so that we'll know what we're doing, so we can make a decision in the late 1980s as to whether or not we will allow industries, utility industries, to build breeders. Now, we almost have to do it. The chances are 99-1 that we will. But we have to get the information first, get all the scientific information so we can handle every conceivable question about it before we start. And that's the purpose of this thing. And, of course, somebody has quoted this cost as how much it is, but this is small compared to the total cost. Every breeder reactor will cost about $1 billion apiece. An ordinary nuclear power plant will cost $750 billion apiece.
What if they gain years on a breeder reactor by studying the French and the British, ones that are online rather than developing our own?
Because it isn't a matter of... that isn't what holds us up. What holds us up is working out acceptable engineering for the United States for approval by regulatory agencies. We have to approve every nut and bolt and design and weld in every reactor. Every weld is x-rayed. If we brought the French reactor over here to start all over again from every nut and bolt and do that all over again, just the same as we would with our own. So there isn't that much to gain. I've been over there. I know all the gross details of the French reactor, and so do hundreds of other people outside. There's no great secret. To answer your question another way, I recently asked the Westinghouse vice president in charge of nuclear power plant production, building. I said, today it takes 10 years for you to get a nuclear power plant, for utility to get a nuclear power plant on the line. From the time they say we'll do it, to the time they get electricity on the line, it takes 10 years. I said, now suppose that you took your last plant, the one you just finished most recently. It's just all been licensed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It's the best plant. It's all safe. Suppose I gave you a piece of land and said you'll have no troubles whatsoever. Build it as fast as you can using normal labor technology, normal labor techniques and so on. How long would it take? He said, 3.5 years. The other 7.5 years we spend on regulations, permits, licenses, investigations, lawsuits, and harassment at about $100 million a year interest rates. That's the problem.